Majors and Quinn presents
Sung Jae Woo.
Now, please join me in welcoming Sung Jae Woo.
Thank you for the introduction. Is this a good level here for the recording? Okay. All right. So this novel is titled Love, Love. And if you look at the cover, it looks like a tennis court because it is. It does have to do with tennis. There are two main characters in this novel. Kevin and Judy, their brother and sister, siblings. And Kevin is an ex-tennis pro, and he is right now a teaching pro at a tennis club when the novel starts. And he is not very happy with his life. And Judy is a temp. And they're both of a certain age. Kevin's 40 and Judy is 38, so they're kind of dissatisfied with their lives. The inciting incident, if you might want to say, is when Kevin finds out that he is going to be donating a kidney to his father and finds some news that is surprising. So I'll read a little bit from there. It's the second chapter, and then I'll read a little bit from another a short section. The whole thing will take about between 13 and 15 minutes. Okay, so I'll start. Kevin made the mistake of getting to Judy's apartment on time. How could he forget that his sister, at her very best, ran half an hour late? Usually he was smarter than this, but he was a little out of it. The phone call from Dr. Elias had done a job on him. "Kevin, I'm sorry," he said, "but you're not a match." The blood type couldn't be the problem. Kevin knew he was the universal donor. "Yes, you're O negative, so that's not the issue," Dr. Elias said. "It's the cross-matching that failed. Simply put, with the current set of drugs available, there's no way we can fool your dad's body into thinking that your kidney is his own. If we drop yours in there, it'll likely fail in a short amount of time." The silence that followed led Kevin to think there was something else Dr. Elias wanted to mention. At the kidney transplant orientation a week ago, the doctor had told the story of how one potential donor, through the rigorous pre-screening tests, was made aware of some deadly disease which would have surely killed him otherwise. I thought you said this was like a routine thing, right? That within family, the matching is guaranteed." "Well, usually, but I'm still wondering." Dr. Elias cleared his throat, and Kevin, who had been on his feet while talking on the telephone, leaned against the edge of his desk for support. This back corner of the pro shop was the closest thing to an office at the tennis club, where he had a small wooden desk, a matching chair, and the upright racket stringer. Kevin stared at the machine, its metallic knobs and quick-release clamps, the piano black finish of its star-shaped base. "Do you remember when we talked about human leukocyte antigens? It was in the tissue typing portion of the presentation." "Yes," Kevin said, more out of fear than actual recollection. He flashed back to classrooms, teachers calling on him for answers he didn't know. Dr. Elias summarized the information for him anyway. "Everyone has 6 unique antigens that are inherited from their parents, 3 from the father and 3 from the mother. So if a child is donating a kidney for his parent, there is a guarantee of at least 3 matches. The ideal donor matched all 6, but even a half match wasn't bad." "So if I'm an O and I matched 3 with my dad, how come it won't take?" "Well, that's the thing," Dr. Elias said. "You don't match at all." "No match. Not one." "I don't understand." Then Dr. Elias said the words that Kevin kept hearing in his head on his way over to Judy's. "What it means is that your father is not your biological father." "My father, not biological," Kevin thought. "I almost failed biology in high school. Maybe if I'd done better, this wouldn't have happened. Maybe if Dr. Elias asked if he was still on the line. I'm here. I'm just okay. All right. I'm terribly sorry to be the one to tell you this, Kevin. I really am. Information of this nature should have come from your parents, but I figured you deserved to know. He thanked Dr. Elias and hung up as fast as he could. He was grateful that a boy came in to have his racket restrung, glad to perform a familiar physical act to bring himself into some sort of equilibrium. Babolat, Copali on the mains, the strings that ran vertically, 49 pounds per square inch. Wilson's synthetic gut on the crosses at 57 pounds. After he had strung three more rackets from the backlog, he felt calm enough to dial Judy, and now here he was, waiting at his sister's apartment in Asbury Park, still dazed. Sitting on the stoop, he watched car after car on her street, tires cutting waves through the heavy rain. He could still remember when this part of Main Street was a simple neighborhood street, no double yellow lines down the middle, kids playing street hockey even around rush hour. It was a sport he had played himself, though always as the goalie, the solitary sentry. Even in team sports, he always found a way to be alone. Was this a trait passed down to him from his unknown father? It felt as if his life so far had been someone else's. At 2 o'clock, Kevin decided he had watched enough of the falling rain. To pass the time, he climbed over the railing to straighten up his sister's patio. Unlike her neighbors, hers was a mess, so much so that he had a hard time figuring where to start. To gain some room, Kevin picked up little piles of newspaper and magazines off the ground. One issue of People dated back a couple of years, the cover story featuring two Britney Spearses, one fat, one thin. Once he had them all stacked against a brick wall, he felt more in control, not only of the immediate surroundings, but of his own life. So his father was somebody else, and his parents didn't want him to know. It was big, but he could handle it. He'd just ask his dad about it, and his dad would apologize and tell Kevin the real story. Simple as that. No big deal. Life goes on. After sweeping up the floor, he went to work on the green plastic table and the two plastic Adirondack chairs. In the corner next to the rusted charcoal grill, Kevin found a sun-faded box of trash bags, so he plucked one out and filled it up with empty beer bottles, sticky plastic cups, and almost empty bags of soggy potato chips that were crowding the tabletop. On one chair were more magazines and newspapers, while the other supported a Jenga-inspired tower of pizza boxes. The last time Kevin saw a disaster like this was back in college, when he had shared an apartment with three other guys, though he had to admit Judy trumped even the combined entropy of three male 19-year-olds. When he was through, he had filled two trash bags to the top, barely able to tie the knots to keep the contents from spilling out. She hadn't bothered to draw her vertical blind, so he cupped his hands and leaned against the balcony window. Not surprisingly, the chaos wasn't limited to the patio. It was actually worse inside, her clothes lying twisted and crumpled everywhere, on the carpeted floor, off the armchair, a sleeve of a shirt desperately clinging onto the finial of a lamp. By the shapes and locations of her discarded clothing, he could guess the actions that precipitated their final repose. Next to the torch lamp was a pair of shorts she had simply dropped and stepped out of, the two holes for her legs looking back at him with fuzzy brown carpet eyes. Skin-colored pantyhose, peeled away after a tiring day of brain-dead temp work, hung limply off the back of her love seat. Food-encrusted dishes competed for real estate. On her coffee table, in an open pizza box with two slices remaining, was balanced on top of the television set. This is how his sister lived, and Kevin felt sorry for her, which was how he felt whenever he visited. A coverless pillow and a frayed blanket were haphazardly piled and pushed against one corner of the sofa, which meant she was still sleeping on the couch. She started doing that when Brian moved out, but that was more than a year ago. As far as he was concerned, Judy was about 6 months behind in breaking out of her funk. An ex-husband could no longer be an excuse for her to just let things go like this. He knew this better than anyone. When Alice left their house, the hardest part of him was getting used to sleeping alone, accepting her vacancy as the new normal. He would wake up in the middle of the night, his hands scrabbling for her body and finding nothing, like a tongue probing at the hollow of a pulled tooth. It was now 2:15. Kevin sat down in one of the chairs and took in the parking lot of the apartment and the row of tall evergreens blocking the view of the strip mall beyond. Rain fell, the soaking kind that came down all day long, the beat of the raindrops so steady that it faded into the background. What it means is that your father is not your biological father. Not a big deal. Who the fuck was he fooling? This was the single most devastating news he'd heard in his life. Not the most difficult. That honor would go to the doctor who announced with sociopathic dispassion that his mother had advanced colon cancer and would at best last a year. How Kevin had wanted to choke him so he'd never be able to speak again. Kevin had trouble even thinking about his recent unpleasant discovery for any length of time. Every time he recalled Dr. Elias's words, other thoughts pushed them out and took their place, like his mother's death, or the state of his sister's living room, or the sad dissolution of his own marriage. A time like this was when you most needed the support and guidance of your partner, but Alice was no longer a part of his life. Like Judy's Brian, she too would forever be referred to with the X prefix. Both he and his sister becoming single again within just months of each other. How the hell did something like that happen? He heard Judy's car before he saw it, the loud whine of the exhaust preceding the squeal of the brakes. There was a hole in her muffler, and although Kevin had referred her to his mechanic, even offered to pay for it, she hadn't done it. By the way the car jerked to a stop, Kevin knew she had put it into park without stopping fully, a terrible habit he had railed against for God only knew how long. Judy emerged from the driver's side door and sprinted in his direction without an umbrella, her footsteps splashing up rainwater like a child running through a puddle. It's the end of the second chapter. I'm going to read one little bit. So there's a part in the middle of the book. This is not a huge surprise. Kevin does find his birth father, and it turns out that he used to be a pornographic actor. So, because of certain issues that his father Norman has, he makes a DVD for Kevin with a voiceover. So this is Norman talking to Kevin in a voiceover on a DVD. Just how is it that I became a porn actor? It's the question I'm most frequently asked. And like most things in life, it's an unplanned event. Things are different now. There are men out there who actually decide and pursue this line of work as if they were going for their MBA. But that's because there's a viable infrastructure. It's all about money, of course. Last year, pornography brought in more than $6 billion. But back in the day, we were just having fun. We got drunk or stoned or a combination of the two. Don't forget, this was the late 60s, early 70s, when everybody was smoking dope and dropping acid. And we were living in a gorgeous house owned by a very rich friend, a guy named Montaigne. And the guy was having a lot of sex with a lot of women. And me and this guy, Rick, were a part of his entourage. So when he tired of certain girls, we got his sloppy seconds, I guess you could say. When he wasn't fucking, Monty liked to take photos, and it wasn't long until he got himself a video camera and started recording us. So this is how it starts. There are all these cute naked girls. There's plenty of alcohol and drugs to go around. You're young, you're beautiful, you're horny. The camera rolls and you don't even see it. You're just goofing off. Then Monty says, let's play. Why don't you, Norman, pretend like you're a plumber? And Jane, you're a bored housewife. Then he actually starts getting props and costumes, and that makes it even more fun. The first movie wasn't scripted at all, one scene after another, just loops made with the Super 8mm with some corny music and amateur dubs added later. But it indeed is a feature-length film because it ran for 81 minutes and we were actually trying to tell a story. Granted, it wasn't much of a story about a wife cheating on her traveling salesman husband while he was away, but there was an attempt to write a script and to act like a proper actor. There was a strip joint in the Tenderloin that showcased nudie films after midnight, so that's where we had our premiere, supposedly. I wasn't there because it was all done without any of our knowledge. I'll stop there. For better or for worse, it's not your normal story, I would say. I try to be as normal as possible, even if there are extraordinary things happening to these characters. I take everything pretty seriously, even something as strange and foreign as the pornographic industry. One person, actually more than one person, has asked, you know, why did you end up writing about this strange sect of the population? And my answer is, you know, writing a book is it's like a marathon. It's a very long process. This book, when I started from beginning to end for the first draft, it took 2 years. I'm not that fast. 2 years, 300 some odd pages, so it averages out to something like half a page a day if I'm writing every day, which I try. So when you are going back to something over and over again and trying to finish something that in the beginning seems like there is no end to it, the best you can hope for is that you have something that you can hold on to, like an anchor. And for me, whether it's a short story or anything that I write, really, whether it be a book, it always starts out with an image. And for me, the image that kind of spurred on this novel is Kevin sitting down and his father handing him an envelope. And this envelope, he opens it. And when he opens it, there is a piece of paper that's folded in threes that cascades down and unfolds, and it's a centerfold of his mother. So that's what, for whatever reason, came to me. And it was very strong, that image. So that's what I am going back to every time I go back to writing the book. So why that happened to be the case, why that image came to me in the first place, I have no idea. I don't know about much of what I do. It just seems to kind of happen. And then it's just, you know, I describe writing a novel as like watching a movie in the slowest possible motion, you know. So it's like, it doesn't always make sense what you're doing. Yeah, you know, it's just like if you can imagine watching a movie in slow motion, much of what you see would not make sense until you keep going and you keep seeing the action as it unfolds. Same thing with the book. Yeah. So that's my little story. This book takes place in both San Francisco and Cape Cod and New Jersey. They're all locations either I've lived in or that I visited that I've liked very much. My first novel was much more autobiographical. This one is not as much, though it still is, like, dissatisfied in the 40s. That part is definitely fiction. Yes, I can guarantee you that. But I am a huge fan of tennis, so I had a lot of fun writing about tennis. Yeah, yeah. So, do you guys have any questions for me? Yes. Sure. So, the question is whether pornography came first, that occurred to me first, or if it was like the discovery of the adoption. I think they're kind of related, really. It seems as if to me the first image was of the mother. So I think the porn must have come first if we're talking about chicken or the egg. yeah, I would think that was kind of the catalyst for the book. Yeah, the other part of the book is split in it kind of halves, and the chapters kind of bounce back and forth. It starts off with Judy, the sister, and then it goes to Kevin, and it just kind of ping-pongs back and forth. And Judy's story is really all about art, which is another thing that I like a lot. In fact, I was just over there at the Minneapolis art thing, but it was closed today. So I was like, oh, God. But I went to the school right next door, which was nice. Yeah. But yeah. Oh, well. Yeah. So I kind of did something similar with my first novel, too. The odd chapters of that novel are in the first person from the point of view of the 12-year-old boy, David, who is kind of like my stand-in. And the even chapters are in the third person from the point of view of everybody else. I seem to only be able to write like kind of halves like this. And my wife tells me it's because I'm a Gemini. Okay. Yeah. The question was like my writing process and whether this is a something that I do, something that can actually sustain me financially. Yes. In my dreams, does it sustain me financially? No, the job that puts food on the table is, believe it or not, computer coding. It's something that I kind of stumbled on into. I never thought I would be doing something like this. But when I started, it was back in like the mid-90s. At which point the internet was like barely a thing, and it was kind of like the Wild West. Nobody knew what was going on, so I was kind of able to somehow worm my way into that line of work. And you know, at this point, I think I'm okay at doing it. At least I hope so. As far as my process is concerned for writing, I almost always write in the morning. Seems like it works best for me if I do it right as I get up and I just go right to the computer. Yeah, like not even like washing my face or brushing my teeth, just do that for about an hour. And you know, it's amazing how much you can get done in an hour, actually. In fact, I would argue that on the days that I have more time, I actually get less done. Because I like to tell people that like there's nothing easier to do than not to write, you know. That's kind of what ends up happening for me. If I have a lot of time, I just end up, I don't know, I, like go to the bookshelves and look at the books. Like I don't know why, you know. Even more dangerous is of course the internet, which is a wonderful tool. But also just a spectacular time waster. One thing I like to actually do, that I actually do in the before I start, is there's a little program called Freedom that runs both on Macs and Windows. It's like some guy made it. It's like $5 or $6. What it does is that when you click on it, it just asks you how much time in minutes. And I think it defaults to like 60 or something. And what that does is it cuts off your internet connection. So you can't get on it. Even if you reboot the machine, it's still there. So you can't really get rid of it. It's really nice. You get much more done, you know. And it's like one of those things where when you're writing, sometimes you think, oh, I gotta look that up because of whatever. But like, no, you don't ever have to look that up. You can just put it in brackets and say like, I'll look up this, you know, later. Or, you know, name of, I don't know, you know, Roosevelt's second cousin. Now you can just put that right there. You don't have to go. And if you do try to look for that stuff, you will get sucked into some other thing, you know, invariably. And it's really counterproductive. So the internet is kind of like my enemy. Yeah, now actually with the smartphones, it's bad because even if I have the freedom on, the phone's there. I gotta get rid of the phone, or maybe get a similar program for the phone. I don't know. Yeah, it's a real challenge. Even though I do write mostly in the mornings, I also try to do it other times too, and in other places. I usually have my little desk that I write on. The novelist Elizabeth Kostova, who wrote The Historian a few years back, wonderful writer. That's one of the advice she gave us when I saw her at the Ann Arbor Book Festival a few years back, and she just said, don't ever limit yourself and say, like, I can only write in the morning, sitting at that desk, you know, between the hour, whatever. No, she said, you can write anywhere, anytime. So do not limit yourself. So I try to do that as well. But there are days where I just can't do it in the morning because I'm going to a doctor or something, or an oil change or whatever. I think that helps. And now, actually, because of the way, like, certain technology works, like Dropbox is what I use to actually back up everything all the time. And that's, like, fully accessible on the phone. So I actually could write if I just have my phone with me. I have done that. The main thing is Dropbox is on the internet, which means the internet is on. So... Yeah. It's really tough though, because all these little apps, they really try to get your attention, whether it be Twitter or Facebook. I mean, if you have those apps running on them, you just get pinged constantly. And they're like little voices saying, read me, pay attention to me. So that's really, I don't know. But my wife and I were in Oregon this summer for about a week and a half, and one of the places we visited was Brighton Bush Hot Springs. It's about 2.5 hours, about 2 hours south of Portland, and that place has no internet, no cell signal, nothing. I got more done in like the 4 days I was there than like in a month. Easily, in both reading and writing. It's just, it really is the biggest challenge at this point, is technology. It's just gonna get worse, they'll just embed stuff into our eyeballs and stuff. it's gonna happen, it's just a matter of time. So
have you ever considered using a typewriter or writing longhand?
Typewriter, I think I could do. That's a really good suggestion. Yeah, longhand I can't do because my writing is terrible as it is, and I've been writing so long on a keyboard that would be a challenge. Yeah, still some writers who do write in longhand. Yeah, I don't know. It is so tedious, right? Hand. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, how often do you get letters anymore? Like, that's handwritten. Anytime I get those, it like floors me. It's so personal. And it just feels like, wow, that person really cares about me. Yeah. Because, I mean, it's like, I don't know. Whenever I write anything that, like, my hand hurts from like holding the pen and just, I mean, it's like, it's a lot of effort. Yeah. Good question. The question is, in the time that I have been writing, what have I learned about myself, about other people, and about life? Golly, that's a big question. Yeah. About myself, I would say, I'm not a very patient person. And writing has kind of forced me to be more patient. So I think that's good, actually. Even though I still feel like I am too impatient. I think if I were more patient, I would probably get more done. Sometimes just being impatient makes things harder to come out, So that's a challenge that I do face. As far as whether Have I learned anything from other people from writing? You know, I think so. I think it's something that really can't be helped. You know, I think just by writing the kind of books that I write anyway. Now, I write character-driven novels. So the more I think about people and the way they interact with one another, even if it's fictitious, and it's not really all that fictitious, really. I mean, when I think of the characters of Kevin and Judy, they're really all just facets of my own self. You know, all the things that I either hate about myself or love about myself or whatever. They're just little slivers that just kind of get reconstituted into characters, you know, really. I think more than anything, I guess I do learn more about myself than anybody else, you know. Writing is such like a solipsistic thing, if you really think about it. It's just, you know, it's just me. under the guise of other people, but it's really you. As far as whether it's taught me anything about life, I really don't know. I think the one thing I do feel, and this kind of has to do with my impatience, is, you know, I feel like that, you know, the cold hand of time always, you know, and when you think about it, you know, no matter who we are, whether we're Bill Gates or the guy on whatever street screaming because he didn't get his lunch or something, you know, we all, like, the time ticks at the same exact rate for all of us, you know. So I really do feel as if, you know, I want to get as much done as possible. At the same time, though, you know, the other side of that is like, does it really matter? You know, I don't know if it really does. Who cares? You know, I don't know if any of this really matters. I mean, it's all great that we have all these wonderful books, but, you know, they'll be here when we're gone. Whatever. If my writing doesn't survive, somebody else will take my place, and that's all right. You know, it's just the way it's as it should be. Yeah. Have I depressed you enough yet? I'm sorry. Sorry.
Do you see any connections between writing and coding?
Yeah. You know, certainly like the logical part of the brain gets exercised for sure, especially when things are heavily plot driven. The book that I'm writing now, the third book that I'm more than halfway through, thank goodness, is a mystery novel. And that genre especially seems to be very logical in the way it works, you know. And the fact that, like, for example, with this book, I really didn't have an outline of any kind. I just kind of just had enough to keep going. E.L. Doctorow, he had a little saying, something like, "It's writing is kind of like driving down a country road at night with your headlights on. You just need to see just ahead, and then eventually you'll get wherever you need to go." So that's like the way this book was written. And can't do the same thing with a mystery novel for sure. If I do that, I'm going to be in a load of trouble. So I wrote a fairly detailed outline. And that one is more like a flowcharty kind of thing. Like if this happens here and that happens here, then I have to do this. And then if that person is there, then I have to make sure the other person is somewhere else. So I would say more than anything, that type of heavily plot-driven work does lend itself to that type of visio-like logic, I would say.
Is there a certain formula you use to write mysteries, kind of like how a lot of people use a certain formula to write romance novels?
I think certain kinds of romance novels are written like that. In fact, I know that for a fact because I have a friend who does write the Harlequin type of romances, and it is like that rigid. Like, by, it's a certain page, you have to have this and this and this. I would think maybe certain mysteries are written that way. But from what I've seen, you know, mystery novels are so broad. There's so many different kinds. I don't think so. Not that I can see. But I certainly haven't, you know, read those kinds. Although I have read enough to see a pattern with certain, like, for example, you're gonna, if you pick up a Dick Francis novel, it's going to have horse racing, you know, of some kind, right? I mean, all the Robert B. Parker novels have Spencer in them, you know, to that degree. But whether structurally they have to be so precise, I don't think so. Yeah. Yeah. But this has been a huge challenge to write this type of a book. I love reading mysteries, you know. They're a load of fun. But constructing them is difficult. And a part of me, as I'm writing it, I just feel like a less of a writer doing it. It's sad, you know. But it's because so much of it is plot driven. It seems as if I'm giving the reader a serious short shrift on the characterization. But like things have to keep moving, and like, you know, things have to keep happening. So I don't know. Although I think the best of mysteries do have everything, you know. So maybe I'm just not doing a good job of it. It's entirely possible. Yeah, like, that's, thank you. That's a wonderful, generous way of looking at it. Yeah. I mean, if you think about, for example, the structure of 10 Little Indians and Murder on the Orient Express, like, I mean, I don't know if they're all that different, right? I mean, it's just kind of flipping the whodunit to a certain degree, just a slight twist. Yeah. But I have to tell you, like, in preparation for writing this mystery novel, I read a bunch, and I basically broke them down into like, I would write a summary of each chapter just to figure out how it was put together. And you'd be surprised how much of them are exactly the same, the way they work. Like, one of the ones I read was, see, Dennis Lehane right over there. It was Moonlight Mile, which was the last of the... Kinsey, or was it? I can't remember. It's the guy and the girl stories. They made a movie out of Gone Baby Gone. It was that one. So it was the last of those that I read. And like, I compare that with another mystery. I can't remember. I think it might have been one of the John D. MacDonald ones. And like, just like on a percentage level, like on the 20th percent of each book, like the exact same thing happened. Like, it really surprised me. Yeah. That, like, plot mechanics wise, they're like, the guy goes to some, the detective goes someplace and gets beat up. Like, it happened in almost the exact same ratio. Yeah. So I think there are patterns like that. At the same time, though, like, they all work. You know, it's not like anybody reads them and thinks like, it's the same thing as, no, the good ones work. Yeah, definitely. I think Dennis Lehane is one of the best ones we have right now. Dennis Lehane right there. See that book up there, The Given Day and World Gone By. Yeah, he's a very, very fine writer who is narratively strong. You know, he can tell, he just has really great writing skills, and he can really twist those plots well. He wrote Mystic River, which was a very good movie. Much better book, but the movie was good too. But yeah, the book is crazy good. Yeah. It's one of those wonderful stories where, like, there's a term for it in when you describe this on a plot level. It's like super and sub. But we know, like, we as readers know more than the characters. So like, when we see, like, you just know that 20 pages later, like, that guy is going to be in a load of trouble, and you feel so bad for him, but you know it's going to happen because you already know certain things that one character knows that the other one doesn't. So you're kind of reading expecting this train wreck, which is going to happen, you know. It's like a car wreck waiting to happen. and your heart just, you know, kind of falls, you know. Yeah, but he's one of the best ones we have. Yeah. Yeah. There are so many. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of great and kind of depressing. Huh? All right. Well, thank you very much for having me here. I really appreciate it. This is the first time for me in Minneapolis, and it's a lovely city you guys have here. So thank you.